Hey everyone, welcome back to the Bible in Context podcast. Last week I said we were going to go through a summary of the book of Genesis so far, but we're actually not going to do that this week. Nate is not with us this week or next, and I really would like to wait for him to do that. So instead, we're going to keep on moving and go into chapter 16 and talk about Hagar and her story with Sarai. But before we do that, I would like to mention just a couple things. The first thing is that we have an email address now associated with the podcast, and so if you have any comments or questions or thoughts that you would like to send in, we would like to hear from you. And so give us an email at thebibleincontextpodcast@gmail.com. And that link should also be in the description of each episode. So reach out, let us know your thoughts, your questions, and we will try our best to get back to you. And if we get enough questions, maybe we can do a Q&A episode. I also want to just mention thank you all for those who are listening. I hope that what we're doing is helpful. And if you do find it helpful, like, subscribe, rate, do whatever you can do on the platform you're listening on. I know we have this podcast on a few different platforms, and so that would be really helpful if you would do those things. That way, if you find this podcast helpful, hopefully others can hear about it and find it helpful as well. Our whole goal here, like we've said from the beginning, is that we want to look at the Bible in its literary and historical context and display how it holds together as a literary unity and creates expectations in the book of Genesis to begin with, and then how that continues throughout the Bible until we see its ultimate fulfillment in Jesus. And again, just understanding Genesis and the way that we're talking about it, I'm hoping will help us to see Jesus in a more clear light. So, like I said, if you found this helpful, like, share, subscribe, rate, whatever you can do, and help others to find it as well and understand their Bibles a little bit better. Well, all right, let's go ahead and dive into the story of Hagar. And her story is an inverted Exodus. I hope by now you're getting more excited whenever I say, hey, another Exodus, instead of hearing it as a drudgery because we bring it up so often. Again, the author has crafted the narrative of Genesis around the motif, the pattern of the Exodus, to teach us new things about Yahweh and these different characters who are being saved and how they act and how they respond to things through these Exodus patterns. So hopefully we're hearing, oh great, another Exodus. We can learn something from this. Another pattern with a slight variation to teach us something about how God is going to respond to Hagar instead of another Exodus. But anyway, that's what we're going to dive into. And this one is definitely different because this is an inverted Exodus. And you'll see how that's true as we get going. To start this story off, we just got done with Abram's covenant with Yahweh regarding the land and the promise that he will still be fruitful and become a kingdom. But still, at the beginning of this story, Sarah does not have a son. And that's what she needs to begin with. And so she comes up with her own scheme in order to obtain this elect son. And she does this because she assumes, in verse 2, that Yahweh is the one who has prevented her from having children. Now, we're going to see later that's not quite true. He's actually the one that enables her to give birth and enables life in her. She is the one who is barren. She's living in a fallen world. These things happen. And Yahweh is the one who brings life to death. So first of all, she falsely assumes that Yahweh is the reason behind the death she experiences within her, at least to say it one way. And then she leans upon this cultural practice of taking servants and using them to get children, basically using them as surrogate mothers for her. Again, this is a very common practice, and so this wasn't just extremely outlandish in their culture or a brand new crazy thought. We look at it that way because, yeah, this is, it's pretty bad. But to them, this was just a normal way to do things. They might just look at this as basically a surrogate mother without all the science that we have today, even though that might be a topic for a different day. But she relies on this scheme, her own plan, using means of the flesh to obtain the promised son that she is supposed to have. All of this stemming from her doubt in Yahweh, her thinking that he is the one who is withholding this blessing, rather than him being the giver of life who will eventually come through. Now, we're going to see this whole process actually carry out in some familiar terms, which are going to really color this this section even farther. So in verse 2, it says that Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. When is the last time that a husband has listened to the voice of his wife in the book of Genesis? Well, that was the fall. Adam listened to the voice of his wife, Eve, when she said, "Here, take the fruit and eat." So that gives this story an ominous sort of tone. But then in verse 3, we're given another link back to the fall in the Garden of Eden. It says that Sarai took Hagar and gave her to Abram, her husband. And again, we have the same language with Eve and Adam. She took the fruit and gave some to her husband, and he ate it. So the moral of the story here is not don't listen to your wives and don't take things from them because they sin. Some people, I mean, I think most of us would hear that and say, well, yeah, that's a really bad way to take this passage. But some have been there, so it's worth saying. And then they try to use Paul to reinforce that, which it's not what he's saying at all. But anyway, what this is telling us is that this whole story looks just like the fall in the Garden of Eden. And this isn't the first time we've seen this. We saw links back to Eden with the sons of God seeing that the women were good and taking them, or Pharaoh seeing that Sarai was beautiful and taking her. There's all these little links throughout the passage that bring us back to that moment. And here is another one. We have Sarai and Abraham committing a sin that looks like the fall. And in that, they are oppressing Hagar, their Egyptian slave. Now, I'll comment more on that in just a second, but first of all, this plan works out, at least on the surface. Hagar does conceive. She has a child that is going to be Sarai's child, but whenever Hagar sees that she has a child and Sarai is still barren, she sees herself as greater and sees Sarai as small in her eyes, begins to look down on her and shows contempt to her. So things get even better between Sarai and Abram. They start to argue. She blames him for everything that happened. And Abram just says, you know what? You deal with it. She's your servant, so do with her as you will. So it says that Sarai dealt harshly with her in verse 6. And this is the same word used throughout the narrative of the Exodus of Israel to talk about the Egyptians oppressing or dealing harshly with the Israelites. The Hebrew word here is anah. And I think this word, if you look up all of its occurrences, it really means something along the lines of to subdue or to take control or to make someone submit or make yourself submit. This word is going to be used later in the same passage, but this word is often used to refer to the oppression of, you know, Egypt, for instance, on Israel, like I just mentioned, or it's used in reference to subduing yourself in fasting before Yahweh. In those cases, it can be translated as humbling yourself. But I think at the root of this idea, you can see how, just for instance, Egypt is subduing Israel in a negative way. And then also, whenever someone is fasting, they are subduing themselves, subduing their desires and their needs in order to humble themselves before Yahweh. So it makes sense why this word is translated as oppression in one place and to humble yourself in another place. But at the root idea of this word is to take control, to subdue, to make something or someone submit. And that's just going to help us out here later in this particular narrative. In verse 6, Sarai anahs Hagar, deals harshly with her. And then in verse 9, the angel of Yahweh tells Hagar to anah herself to Sarai. So we have Sarai subduing Hagar in a negative sense, and then we have Hagar returning and subduing herself before Sarai. I just wanted to point this out because if any of you are looking at this in the Hebrew or have this pointed out in a commentary, it is kind of odd that Sarai oppresses Hagar, and then somehow Hagar has the same word applied to her when she goes back to Sarai, as though she were necessarily oppressing herself, or like the angel of Yahweh wants Sarai to go back and be oppressed. But the idea of to subdue just makes a little more sense of this word and how both Sarai and Hagar can both anah in this passage. So, whenever Hagar is anahed, when she is oppressed, when she is subdued, or when Sarai takes control of her, she flees. She flees from the elect family in the same way that Israel will flee from Egypt in Exodus 14:5. So again, there's another connection, and we'll see fleeing show up again in the Exodus motif in Genesis with Jacob. But whenever she flees to the land of Shur, the wilderness of Shur. Now, why is that place significant? Whenever the Israelites leave the Red Sea crossing, the first place that they go is Shur, or at least a place called Shur. It probably just has the same name, rather than being the exact same place. But that name is placed there intentionally by the author. We're supposed to see a link between the Shur that the Israelites go to and the Shur that Hagar goes to. Now, while she's in Shur, she comes to a spring. And this one's a little more loose in my mind, but I think it's worth bringing up because once Israel gets to the wilderness of Shur in Exodus 15, they go 3 days without water, and then they come to the bitter waters of Mara, and the waters are made sweet. Yahweh provides water for them, and then after that they come to Elim, where there is an abundance of trees and springs for all the people. So again, possibly kind of a loose connection, but they both go to the wilderness of Shur, and then in this place there is some kind of issue with water or springs or wells being provided by Yahweh. It happens a little differently in each case, but again, I think it's worth mentioning. Now, if Hagar is in the land of Shur, that is actually south of where Abraham was in Hebron. So what does that tell us about Hagar's journey? It's very possible that she was headed south because she wanted to go back to Egypt. She wanted to go back home, and I think that would make a lot of sense. And it's at this point that we really see how inverted this Exodus narrative is. Instead of Egypt oppressing the elect family, as we have with Pharaoh and Sarai, and as we will have with Pharaoh and the Israelites later in the Bible, now we have the elect family oppressing the Egyptian slave. So it completely flips our expectations of what an Exodus should look like. Because when we think Exodus, and I think when the Israelites think the culmination of the Exodus, they're thinking, yeah, those Egyptians, they enslaved us Israelites, and then we were given liberation by Yahweh from that. But this says, no, even the elect family can become oppressors if they're not careful. And they can even oppress the oppressive, quote-unquote, Egyptians. So it just takes all the expectations and pulls the rug out from under them and really shows that it doesn't matter who you are, you can end up on either side of this oppressor-oppressee dynamic. I think in that the author really is taking a shot at the same things that Jesus is taking shots at with the Pharisees whenever he says, you know, you think I have Abraham as my father. But he's saying, no, it doesn't matter who you are. You can end up as oppressive Egypt, even if you are the religious elite of God's chosen people. And so we keep going here. And again, instead of the Israelites being brought away from Egypt, we have the Egyptian fleeing the oppressive elect people and trying to get Exodus back to Egypt, trying to go back to the safe place in Egypt for her. And this is where we come across this figure called the Angel of the Lord, or the Angel of Yahweh. And this is the first time that we meet the Angel of Yahweh in the Bible. And in this instance, there's some very interesting things said about the Angel of Yahweh to show us that this character is Yahweh, but also somehow distinct from Yahweh in the fact that he's called the angel. But this character is Yahweh. Now, the first thing is that the angel of Yahweh in verse 11 and 12 gives a blessing that sounds very much like the blessings that Yahweh has given to his chosen people so far throughout the narrative of Genesis. That's not a surefire thing saying, yeah, this angel of Yahweh is Yahweh as well, but it's suspicious. It should put your antennas up and make you wonder, what's going on here? Why is the angel the one saying this? Well, we get down to verse 13 right after this blessing, and it says, Hagar called the name of Yahweh who spoke with her. You are a God of seeing. The author explicitly tells us that this angel of Yahweh who has been talking with Hagar is Yahweh himself in some manifestation that can come and talk to Hagar and see her. So really this makes the profundity of this scene that much greater. Again, we have this reversed Exodus. We have the Egyptian who is oppressed, the Egyptian who needs Exodus, and then Yahweh comes and meets with her himself. And not only that, but gives Hagar and her son a blessing that sounds a lot like the blessings of the elect ones of Yahweh. Let me just go ahead and read that blessing that the angel of Yahweh gives to Hagar in verse 11 and 12. It says, behold, you are pregnant, and you shall bear a son. This is the child that Abraham is having with her. You shall call his name Ishmael, because Yahweh has listened to your affliction. He shall be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. He shall dwell over against his kinsmen. Now, one more Exodus thing I want to point out in this blessing is that it says, Yahweh has listened to your affliction. And we've seen a few times already that Yahweh continually sees the oppression of the oppressed, or listens, or hears. In some way, he comes to know of the oppression of the oppressed and then comes to rescue his elect, or in this case, Hagar, who's strangely not an elect. But the fact that Yahweh sees and hears her oppression is just one more thing that links this narrative to the Exodus narrative. Okay, so what's going on with this blessing? We're told that Hagar has conceived, that he's going to be a wild donkey of a man, he's going to be violent and over against all of his relatives, and they will be against him. So again, we already see the beginnings of the brotherly strife motif in this character, who is going to be at odds with his kinsmen. But what is most significant here, I think, is that Yahweh names him Ishmael, which means God hears. Now, what's most significant about that is not that his name means God hears, that is significant, but it's the fact that Yahweh names him. We've seen already how when Yahweh names something, he is performing an act of functional creation. If you remember that functional ontology principle, he removes something from the raw material, he fashions it, he sets it aside for another purpose, and then it is a new thing. It is newly created, or created into something else. We see that principle at work all through the creation narrative. You can go back and listen to those episodes if you want to dive into that a little deeper. And we also see the same principle at work all throughout the ancient Near East. And again, John Walton has an entire book devoted to this, Genesis 1 as Ancient Cosmology. So if you want to dive deeper into that, check that out. But this principle is at work, yeah, like I said, in the ancient Near East and in the Bible. And so here, whenever Yahweh names Israel, he is setting him aside and declaring his destiny. In terms of functional ontology, he is creating Ishmael anew. And that is, once again, one more link to the Exodus narrative, because we know that Israel is recreated as they come through the sea, as they are set aside for the new purpose of being Yahweh's nation of priests. And we see the same thing happen with Adam and Eve, and then we see a different kind of recreation happen with Noah as he comes through the waters, and the entire world is actually recreated. So again, we just see another step of this Exodus motif active in the new creation of Ishmael. And we also see, I think, just an added layer of grace and care and love towards this non-elect part of Abraham's household, in that even they get this Exodus and this blessing and this new creation status. Yahweh hasn't taken the rest of humanity and, you know, he's chosen Abraham's family. I'm just going to throw the rest of them out. I don't need them. No, he wants to redeem them. He wants to bless them. He wants to create them anew. And, well, we're going to see later in the Old Testament, if we get there, that he wants the nations to be part of his nation of priests. But at least here we can see that God has his attention and his care focused on even a non-elect family. Okay, so let me back up, though, for just a minute and talk about this blessing and recreation as far as what it does for us in the current narrative. All of us know the book of Genesis. All of us know how the story of the Bible plays out, probably. And so we know, hindsight's 20/20, that Ishmael is not the chosen seed. So we can look back and see the grace and the care that Yahweh has on him in this blessing and naming. But just pretend we're reading this for the first time. So far, Abraham doesn't have another son, and Sarai thought that Yahweh hasn't allowed her to have any kids, so she comes up with this scheme, and she gets a kid out of it, and then Yahweh comes and blesses this kid. What are we thinking if we were first-time readers of this? I think we would be right to think, wait, is Ishmael the chosen seed? Is he the one that Yahweh is actually going to bless and is going to become Abraham's child and Sarai is going to adopt to be her chosen son? At this point in the story, that really seems to be the case. As we go into the next chapter, we're going to be asking, is Ishmael the chosen son? Is he the one that is blessed by Yahweh? Did Sarai's scheme actually work and get them the elect son through this method of slavery surrogacy? Well, I guess we will have to continue reading and see. But for now, Hagar gets this blessing. She obeys Yahweh and goes back to her mistress, Sarai. She names the well where Yahweh came to her and calls it Well of the Living One Who Sees Me before she returns. And then we're left to infer that Hagar does indeed return and she has her child. That child is given to Abram and names him Ishmael. We're then given a little note at the very end of the chapter in verse 16 that Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. And that is going to be a little narrative break between chapter 16 and chapter 17. But it's a break that implies continuity between the two chapters, because chapter 17 starts off with a note about Abraham's later age. So there is a very clear disconnection that there was a long time between when the events of chapter 16 happened and the events of chapter 17 happened. But because both of these sections close and open with Abram's age, it does show that these are still meant to be read together. It's not a disconnected new story, but rather a scene change in the same movie. And I think Nate and I have probably talked about that a lot, and we want to keep saying it, that the book of Genesis is not a bunch of random stories. It is a flowing narrative. If it were a movie, it'd be one big movie where each part builds on the same story and prepares for the same themes later on in this story. And then we'll get to, you know, the rest of, you know, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and those are just going to be, you know, our second, third, fourth, and fifth installments in the same movie series. So this is one big continuous narrative that we're meant to understand. And reading it like that, we're going to get a lot more out of it. So before we end this one, and we'll move on to chapter 17 next week, I just want to recap one more time briefly the elements of the Exodus narrative in Hagar's story, in her inverted Exodus. In the Exodus, we have an oppressive king, and in this story, we have an oppressive elect family, ironically. And then she flees towards Egypt, just like Israel flees from Egypt. Just like Israel, she ends up in the wilderness of Shur, in a place called Shur. And there's something to do with wells and springs involved in both of these stories. Then we have Yahweh and the angel of Yahweh who listen to the affliction of their people, or in this case, to Hagar, who is part of Abram's household, and that's significant. But still, she's not directly the elect one. So again, I think it's significant that he looks on her with the care that he does. He didn't have to. When she ran away, he could have said, okay, well, I'm not choosing Ishmael for my elect one anyway, so be gone with you. He doesn't do that. Then Hagar, she is brought back to the elect family. And I think that there's reason to see this as corresponding to Israel being brought into the land. They're brought back into Yahweh's dwelling because Yahweh's blessing lies with the elect one. That's where Hagar is brought back to. So we see also in this passage, she is given a blessing to be fruitful, and she's going to be multiplied. Her son is going to become a nation. We see that blessing happen a little bit more later on, but we still see the seeds of it here. And Israel obviously gets those same blessings, in particular in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 11. And then we have a blessing of new creation or new humanity in Ishmael, just like happened with Adam and will happen with Israel. So, another Exodus narrative for us to learn from, new characters who are part of the elect household, but not quite the elect ones. So we have some new elements of this Exodus motif that we can meditate on and learn more about Yahweh and who it is he cares about. So, awesome. Let's jump back in next week into chapter 17 and look at Abram's next covenant with Yahweh. And again, don't forget, if you have any questions, comments, thoughts, you know, email them in. We would love to hear from you guys. So, thanks for listening.